This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. You may know Sebastian Junger's work from his remarkable film Restrepo, a documentary which follows the deployment of a platoon of American soldiers in Afghanistan's Korangal Valley. It was nominated for an Academy Award. But Junger's interest in and involvement with these soldiers did not end there. In June, he released a second film, Korangal, This Is What War Feels Like, taking a deeper look at the same platoon in the same valley. And last night, his latest film, The Last Patrol, debuted on HBO. It examines life after combat and why, for some, combat is so hard to give up. We're going to spend the hour on this Veterans Day talking about the challenges faced by men and women returning from combat missions in the Middle East and the difficulties they face reacclimating to civilian life. And we are pleased that Sebastian Junger is with us for the hour. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
We're also joined by two local folks who are working to help in the transition back to military life. Dr. Dave Calloway is director of the Division of Operational and Disaster Medicine at Carolinas Medical Center and a Navy veteran. Thank you for being here. Oh, let me turn your mic on. You can say that again. Welcome.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be here.
And Paula Broadwell is a leadership consultant with the Center for Intentional Leadership, an Army veteran, active reservist, author of All In, The Education of General David Petraeus. She also serves as an advisor for several veteran support organizations, including Charlotte Bridge Home, Purple Heart Homes, and Patriot Charities. And she works with a veteran-founded and run organization called Lead Star. What is Lead Star, Paula?
Lead Star is an organization that was founded by veterans to consult corporations and bring best practices from the battlefield to the boardroom.
And you're on your way to where now? Africa tomorrow?
This afternoon I head to Africa to work with an oil company and share some of those best practices.
Okay. And I should mention that there will be a screening of Korangal, This Is What War Feels Like, and a conversation with filmmaker Sebastian Junger this Friday at 6 at the Wells Fargo Auditorium, which is underneath the Knight Theater down there on South Tryon. It's sponsored by Charlotte Bridge Home. We have information about that on our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Your first book, Sebastian, dealt with things other than war. The Perfect Storm, of course, detailed the loss of a fishing vessel and its 6 crew members off Nova Scotia. It was an international bestseller. It was made into a movie. Then along came a nonfiction account of the rape of a woman from your hometown. Then a book called Fire, which is a collection of articles about people in dangerous occupations and in dangerous regions of the world. In that book, you wrote about Afghan Northern Alliance leader Ahmad Shah Massoud. Your next several projects, however, all dealt with these U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. Did your interest in that area of the world and that part of that occupation and that war come from your conversation with Massoud, or did it come from something else?
Well, I first went to Afghanistan in 1996. It was a very tortured, dramatic, compelling country to me in the wake of the Soviet invasion and withdrawal and our subsequent withdrawal of support after the Soviets pulled out. And I went there during a time of terrible civil war and turmoil. And then I followed up with – I was with Massoud in the fall of 2000, a year before 9/11. I sort of fell in love with that country a little bit. It's a very beautiful, amazing place. And then 9/11 happened, and it was such an easy war at first. I was there when Kabul fell, when the Taliban were pushed out of Kabul. The Afghans were truly joyful at the help that we were giving them. And then I watched the war effort just sort of crumble as we lost our focus and focused on Iraq. And I was really disappointed. I thought Afghanistan was like one we could win and that we'd bring a lot of good to the Afghan people. And I still hope it'll turn out well. But by 2007, it was clear that we were suffering the consequences of some bad decisions. And I wanted to – you know, it was turning into a real war, and I wanted to know what it was like to be a soldier, American soldier in combat in Afghanistan for a year. I mean, it was turning into the real thing, and I wanted to know what that was like.
And you pretty much gave us the idea of what that's like through your film Restrepo, which really puts us in the middle of everything without the bullets flying past our heads, I suppose. You focused on these men in combat, on what they experience while in combat, how they deal with fear, how they deal with danger, how they deal with the periods of intense boredom that comes their way every once in a while, and how the experience of war changes them. But you were there too. Did it change you?
Oh, profoundly. Absolutely. I was there off and on for a year, and so was my colleague, Tim Hetherington. He started shooting video about 5 months into the project, and so with two of us shooting video, we were able to, sort of alternating trips, we were able to capture a lot of the deployment. And I came home, I wouldn't say traumatized. I mean, I'd been traumatized several times in my career as a journalist in various civil wars in Africa and elsewhere, and in Afghanistan with Massoud, actually, very badly. I wouldn't say traumatized so much, but just sort of cracked open emotionally in ways that I still don't quite understand. And that had a huge impact on my life, actually, for some years.
All three of you are veterans. All three of you deal with veterans of these conflicts, these recent conflicts. What don't we, who are not veterans, people who think, well, we sent our men and women over there to fight the war and don't realize that we are fighting the war because we don't even see it in our living rooms anymore. What don't we understand about what they experience?
Are you asking me?
I'm asking all three of you.
Okay.
I'll jump in. Well, first of all, about less than 1% of the population serves. So you're right, Mike, that a lot of people can't relate to what that experience is. Thanks to reporters and journalists like Sebastian Younger, we can watch these films and try to convey to the public what some of those challenges are. But there's nothing like experiencing it firsthand. And I think the biggest challenge that soldiers have when they come back, especially those who separate from the service and no longer have their quote-unquote tribe, mm-hmm. is a loss of belonging to something greater than themselves. And one thing we've really worked hard to do here in Charlotte is to connect those veterans with something again, with the community, with an organization, with a running club, with a professional opportunity. So the thing I think they leave behind or that we don't understand is that camaraderie, that selfless service, that willingness to give your life for the guy to the right and left of you. They sort of leave that behind, and a lot of people can't relate to it here. It's not part of our society to act like that.
Dr. Calloway?
Well, I mean, I think you and Paula and Sebastian have hit on a key topic. It's this idea of shared sacrifice. I mean, we're in the middle of the longest, most sustained, and perhaps the most complex morally challenging combat period in the history of our country. We've got, a generation of young men and women who are spending years, 5, 6, 7 years, 15 deployments fighting counterinsurgency warfare. And they come back to the United States and it's hard for them to explain and it's hard for our citizens to ask the questions and to understand. I think it's doable. I think that, things like war and Korengal and the reporting that Sebastian does and these other shared experiences are really critical to looking at how we can reintegrate veterans, not just to help fix them, because they don't need to be fixed, but to help them grow and contribute and lead in our community.
You wrote an opinion piece, Sebastian, in the Washington Post. I'm not sure when this ran, but you said some things that I'm not sure many people who have not been a part of these conflicts directly have ever considered. You say that soldiers face myriad challenges when they return home, but one of the most destructive is the sense that their country doesn't quite realize that it, and not just the soldiers, went to war. The country approved, financed, and justified war, sent the soldiers to fight it. And you say that this growing cultural gap between American society and our military is dangerous and unhealthy.
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand that as a species, we are adapted to live in groups of 30, 40, 50 people. That was pretty typical community size in our prehistory. And there was a lot of warfare in our prehistory. And in that kind of situation, any of the young men who went out to fight, to hunt or to fight, both very dangerous things, were clearly doing so in service of the community, at the behest of the community. The consequences that they suffered were generally suffered by everybody. It was clear to everyone that this was a group enterprise, even though it was only the young men who actually were holding spears in their hands and or whatever. And we live in such a complex industrial society that it's possible to sort of farm out these very important jobs, not just the military. I mean, we need oil. There's oil rig workers who get hurt all the time. We're not connected to them. loggers, commercial fishermen. They're very, very, very dangerous jobs out there that we depend on as a nation. But we don't really acknowledge the relationship between us and the people who do those jobs. And it's very, very true of the soldiers. So what probably the single best thing that a civilian can do for veterans is to make it clear somehow that even if you oppose the war, and plenty of people do for perfectly good reasons, that as an American, you understand ultimately it is your war. I mean, the 19-year-olds who are fighting it are probably the least responsible for the fact that we're at war, just because they're the youngest in the equation. All the adults, us, were responsible for it, for better or worse. And I'm not a reflexively anti-war person at all. I understand there's wars that need to be fought. And I think after 9/11, when we went to Afghanistan, I think that was one of them. But right or wrong, it's all of us. And soldiers come back and they get the feeling that people think it's their war just because they were pulling the trigger. Ethically, morally, historically, it just is not.
I read a lot of things that you and others wrote yesterday, and I'm not sure this is what you said or somebody else said, but somebody talks about how these soldiers are not politically involved. When they're over there, they're not sitting around the campfire talking politics, left and right, Democrat, Republican. Oh, should be here, should not be here. They're focused on the mission, surviving, their buddies, etc. And they come home, and there are people who don't like the war. There are people who are very much in favor of the war. And they've never really been talking about those things. Is that you or somebody else writing about that?
I've certainly mentioned that, mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very, very true. I mean, the guys that I was with in Restrepo, Restrepo was – there was an awful lot of combat out there. Mm-hmm. But all of them were, volunteered, right? They volunteered because they – frankly, they wanted to be combat infantry. I mean, if you just need a job, there's lots of jobs in the U.S. military you can do and not get shot at. And most jobs, actually, you don't get shot at in the U.S. military. But if you're going to be 173rd Airborne, you're clearly like – in your mind, making the football team, right? Yeah. And so when they were out there, they just didn't discuss the right and wrong of the war. It just wasn't an issue. I mean, and again, like oil rig workers aren't discussing global warming on their lunch break. Like it's not part of their reality.
And in your book, War, you construct that book in three sections, fear, killing, and love. Is that, when you boil it down, is that what war is to you?
To me, the experience of war for soldiers, for the soldiers I was with, did seem to come down to those three emotional experiences. Love, of course, is the very intense sort of brotherhood bond. It was all men out there at the at Restrepo, OP Restrepo. The very intense brotherhood bond that is created even between men who don't like each other very much in situations of combat. I was trying to answer this sort of one question that I'd always been puzzled by. Why would someone throw themselves on a hand grenade to save other people they're not related to? I mean, I totally get it. Save your children, save your wife, but your peers, it didn't make sense to me in Darwinian terms.
That's Sebastian Junger, filmmaker, author of filmmaker of Restrepo, Korengal, This Is What War Feels Like, and The Last Patrol, which debuted last night on HBO. Also with us, Dr. Dave Calloway, a veteran, and Paula Broadwell. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fox Broadcasting, presenting the new season of MasterChef Junior and new episodes of New Girl and The Mindy Project. It's a night that's both fun and funny, starting at 8 p.m. tonight on Fox 46, Carolinas. And Dixon Hughes Goodman LLP, a CPA and advisory firm headquartered in Charlotte with over 1,700 professionals in 30 offices, serving clients in the U.S. and around the world. Details at DHGLLP.com. There's a downside to processed food. It's not good for you, and much of it isn't food. So a mom from Matthews decided to feed her family, to see if she could feed her family for 100 days using no processed food. Well, guess what? She could. And now she's written her own cookbook about the experience with recipes that will help you make the transition as well. And Lisa Leek will talk about her 100 days of real food with us tomorrow.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, only 5% of Americans have a direct tie to our military. This disconnect often leads to misperceptions about veterans, how to bridge the civilian-military divide, and valuing the contributions of veterans beyond the battlefield.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHEI. Mike Collins. We're talking today with Sebastian Younger, filmmaker. His film, Coringall, This Is What War Feels Like, which is a follow-up to his Academy Award-nominated film Restrepo, follows the same men in the battle in the Coringall Valley of Afghanistan. It will be screened Friday, November the 14th at Wells Fargo Auditorium at 6 p.m., and Sebastian will be here to talk about it afterward, and we have information about that on our website. He is here along with Dr. Dave Calloway, Director of Operational and Disaster Medicine for Carolina's Medical Center, a Navy vet, Paula Broadwell, an Army vet, and a leadership consultant now for the Center for Intentional Leadership, Charlotte Bridge Home, and also for a Lead Star. Before we talk about some of the things going on in Charlotte with these young men and women who are coming home from these conflicts and how we're handling it, and I'm told by Paula that we're handling it extremely well, actually, in Charlotte. I want to talk a little bit more about these guys and the men and women who are over there. And one of the things that you point out that comes out in your film, I think, Coringall, is that all those soldiers suffer in war and they witness death and dying and destruction and they experience great fear and hardship. A lot of them find themselves missing combat after they've left combat zones. Do you understand why, Sebastian?
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, there's a lot of things going on in combat. I mean, first of all, it's a very adrenalized situation. Young men, I think, in particular, respond to that kind of danger and coordinated effort in very, very sort of almost intoxicated ways. I mean, you can see the death rate from accidents and violence in society here in young men is something like six times what it is of young women. I mean, they're just – young men are risk takers inherently and in war and outside of war. But in a sort of – in a more profound way, they miss the brotherhood of combat. And again, you go back to our ancestral roots, we evolved to live in groups of 30, 40, 50 people in a hostile environment where everyone's completely interdependent, interreliant on each other, and everything's done in great coordination with the group. That's a platoon in combat. I mean, you're literally sleeping shoulder to shoulder. And there is great emotional and physical safety that comes from that closeness. In fact, that closeness is the only thing keeping you alive in combat, is the fact that you're not out there by yourself. And so then these guys come home, and they come home to a society which is incredibly alienated and fragmented. I mean, suddenly you're living in your single-family house at the end of a cul-de-sac in an exurb. We weren't really designed to live like that. And as a result, industrial society, post-industrial society, has the highest rates of suicide and depression and insomnia and anxiety and loneliness and child abuse ever in human history. So what these guys are coming back from an intensely ancient human experience to a society which is really not conducive to human happiness. And you can see that just from the broader statistics.
You told ABC News that these vets – and this is a quote from that interview. These vets come home to a wide-open society where people are living by themselves in little apartments. And frankly, I think they're just lonely. Does that manifest itself, Paula, when you talk to these vets coming home and you're trying to help them establish life here and place them here in jobs?
It definitely does, Mike. And I think Sebastian's hit on it. They're leaving behind a brotherhood or sisterhood, and nothing in civilian society really replaces it. Mm-hmm. I suppose being on a fire squad or a police squad or something like that, you have a similar camaraderie. And I think you can recreate it in small ways by, again, athletic teams where there's some source of adrenaline, some source of camaraderie and helping each other out, having each other's backs. But it's definitely a challenge. And that's why it's important to have someone who can speak your language when you come back. An organization, whether it's the VA or veterans in the community like Dave, who can identify with an incoming medic who wants to work at the hospital, Dave knows what that guy's background is, and he knows he's going to be reliable, and he's going to find a way to get the job done. But that medic may not be able to translate his skills from the battlefield to a civilian hospital. So finding someone like Dave who can help and mentor makes that transition so much easier.
Why is that transition difficult? Because your area of expertise and what your job is operational and disaster medicine. And God knows, on a battlefield where the medic is the lifeline for the soldier who's been wounded, that's a disaster field. Why are the skills from that environment so difficult to translate?
I mean, Mike, when I returned from Iraq, I felt this profound sense of loss and loneliness. And I couldn't figure it out. And I felt this guilt because I wanted to go back. And I had a single mom, only child, and she was horrified and devastated while I was deployed. And I had this massive sense of guilt because I wanted that sense of purpose, that every single decision you made had consequence. And so when I transitioned to the civilian setting, I had the same challenge. I said, man, there's nothing out there that I could do that would give me that sense of mission, sense of purpose like I had before. And so I started looking at disaster medicine, disaster response, and trying to figure out ways to get veterans who are returning from combat zones engaged in these areas, both civilian and domestic and international, where they could put these skills to use. They could regain that sense of mission and purpose and help build both the civilian knowledge, but also give them this bridge to transition to, you know, maybe a more normal, sustainable life where they're getting some of that adrenaline. They're capturing some of that physiologic response, that brotherhood, that bond, and making a difference.
Is it more than adrenaline? Because what you're talking about, this missing the idea that every decision you make is life or death, that seems like a drug to me.
It is.
And not adrenaline.
No. And you know, Chris Hedges wrote a book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. And I read that when I got back. And it helped me put a lot of things into context. And then Sebastian's writings have also hit on this. There are psychologic and physiologic changes that happen to you. And the physiologic is adrenaline. It is addicting. It is, you know, a gunfight or bombs going off while you're operating on somebody. I mean, that is addicting. That is something that is hard to capture. But the physiologic or the psychologic side of coming back and finding that bond, you know, looking around and seeing somebody else who has a mission and a purpose is equally critical.
How do you come down from that? What do you replace that with?
Well, I think that's the challenge that we're facing right now is because society is, you know, Sebastian, again, talks about this isolated, lonely society. We're scared to ask those questions. We have structure in place in our society about what a doctor should look like or what a teacher should look like or a business person should look like. When I look at these veterans, you know, I think that the narrative has been defined by either the broken vet or the hero vet. And it's a lot more complex. We need to have the courage to have those conversations. I see innovators. I see leaders. I see followers. I see people who are going to change the system. I see healers. Mm-hmm. And this is what we need to let them know, that there's a role for them leading our communities, leading our societies forward.
Some veterans see combat, others do not. But those that are in a combat unit, one would assume that they've all gone through the same things at the same time, experienced the same feelings, the same fear, the same joy at winning, or the same grief and tragedy at losing a comrade. But others handle it. Some people handle it differently than others. Do we understand why?
We don't. And part of it is, what was their mindset before they got there? What was their level of training? And it's the fundamental question. So the guy who gets blown up and loses two legs, what is the difference between him taking a gun to his head or becoming a, you know, triathlete? Mm-hmm. We don't know that. I mean, we can look and see that there are key identifiable components like, you know, bond, support, creating a new mission, helping them feel like they're not just a victim, but they're actually adding value to society. Restoring that into a warrior is critical, I think, in helping them come back from that edge.
Let me just jump in here quickly. Yeah. I have a couple of interesting facts that I think are relevant. I mean, first of all, the rate of PTSD in the Israeli military is something like 1%. It's far, far lower than the U.S. military. And one of the reasons I heard is that they screen for predisposition for PTSD, and they keep those people out of combat units. So if you have a history of depression, suicidal thoughts, that kind of thing, you definitely don't want to put that person in combat because that elevates the chances of that kind of behavior afterwards. Mm. Another really interesting thing that I read is that the suicide rate, which is tragic in the U.S. military and in our society as a whole, frankly, But the suicide rate in veterans is not connected to the amount of combat experienced. It's not connected to that. That's what I heard. And so I just think that's a sort of – those are sort of interesting facts to keep in mind when you figure out how people experience war and what the effects are going to be afterwards.
But soldiers in war have been trained. I don't know that you can ever really fully prepare somebody who's never been in combat for what they're going to experience when they're in combat, but they are highly trained personnel. War correspondents are not highly trained for that aspect of their lives, one would seem. And both you, Sebastian, and Paula have been war correspondents. You covered it in Afghanistan for the Washington Post. Paula, what prepares – of course, you had military training as well, but what prepares these – war correspondents to do what they do, because they are in harm's way?
I think a lot of war correspondents don't prepare. And I hope that Dave talks a little bit about the work that he does to try to train war correspondents, medics, doctors with Doctors Without Borders, and others who go to these combat zones to best prepare not to find themselves on a video with ISIS getting beheaded. I drew on my background and my contacts and network when I was traveling around Afghanistan, and just had a sense of confidence in their capability to support my movement when I had requests and that kind of thing. There's, you know, I won't deny that I probably was seeking a little bit of that adrenaline too. I was first to say it's so good to be back with my tribe, even though I was there as a reporter, as a journalist, and I was just blogging correct the record. I had great support from the military. Now, a lot of reporters go and they're on their own, and I'll defer to Sebastian for his brave acts to go out in the field with the troopers. But it's essential to prepare. The military does a great job in facilitating movement, because I think we've learned through these wars it is important to be first with truth and to try to communicate to the public what's going on, or we will not gain public support. But there are still many challenges in places like Syria and back in Iraq again now.
And Sebastian, you said that you you told one interviewer that you went to war to become a man. And I think a lot of guys sign up. Now that there's no draft, they sign up because they want to fulfill their manhood. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's
or womanhood.
It's a complicated sentence to say, and it sounds very old-fashioned, but I think, you know, I grew up in a really affluent suburb, and I felt like I'd never been tested in any real way by life, and that one of the things that matures people is adversity. And it just was not being shoved. Adversity was not being shoved upon me, and I felt like I had to kind of seek it, or I would be stuck in a sort of perpetual state of immaturity. And since I'm male, I phrased it as becoming a man, and it. In a very complicated ways that I didn't anticipate, it did kind of work that way eventually.
You were nodding in recognition of that, Doctor.
Well, I mean, so 2 points. One is I completely agree. I mean, I think in society, modern society, life is easy. And there is no denying for the majority of us in America, life is easy. And so the question is, when you look back historically and you see your heroes and you see these people have risen in adversity and you say, what's a challenge that's going to make me become a moral leader in my community, you know, frankly, war or combat offers that challenge. It offers the most complex decisions you can make.
But you don't really know that going in. I mean, we romanticize war.
Absolutely.
in our culture. And I think that's because we are removed from it. We
right.
don't really see it. We don't see people being killed in combat on television. We don't see bodies on television. If you go to other parts of the world, you do see that on television on there. We don't. Is that hurting or helping us? Is that leading to this idea that I have to go to war to be a man? And by extraction, is that leading our leaders to say, well, we can solve our problems by going to war?
I mean, I think the romanticized –
because they're not going. Right, they're sending young right. men and women to go.
The romanticized notion of combat and war is absolutely a problem. I don't – you know – is it the problem? I don't think so. But it is. I mean, we have a false idea of what combat means. And again, guys like Sebastian and other reporters who are on the front lines of these democracy movements who are talking about conflict and strife, I mean, they offer an insight. And for many people, they see that insight and they say, man, that's purpose. Yeah. That's a mission.
Well, Sebastian Younger, you were there as a correspondent, as a filmmaker, and you spent an enormous amount of time not only talking and living with these soldiers, but also going back and looking at what they said and studying what they said to put together three different films now about this combat unit. What did they say about the romanticization of, if that's the right word, of war?
Well, I should start by saying that I think war does get romanticized, and that's not a new thing. The Greeks glorified war tremendously. The Maori, the Apache, the Cheyenne, the Sioux—I mean, all of it, in all of these tribal cultures, it was absolutely a sort of noble enterprise and something for young men to want to participate in as a path to honor in their society. So this is a really ancient thing, and. The fact that we're still doing it, I think, just shows the sort of eternal nature of humanity rather than a sort of modern aberration.
Mike, I think if I can just jump in here, I'll speak for the women in the sisterhood and many others who are not necessarily drawn to go into combat to prove themselves, but they're drawn to the military because of the leadership training it provides. There's that old question about our leaders born or made. And I really do believe the military, through the adversity that Sebastian is talking about, but just through the austerity and having to make those critical decisions and being trained and educated on how to do it properly, is what a number of our servicemen and women are drawn to.
You've done three films with these guys from the original movie Restrepo, which put the viewer into the combat zone and let you feel what it feels like. Then your second film about this, Karangal, This Is What War Feels Like, actually lets these guys talk about fear and courage and camaraderie. How did you get them to honestly share their feelings about fear? These are guys who are out in the combat zone, and why would they make themselves vulnerable to you?
Well, I think just because Tim and I spent so much time with them. You know, we were with them off and on for a year. We suffered the same dangers and hardships that they did.
Tim is Tim Hetherington, who was your photographer.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And Tim, I need to say, was killed in combat in Libya shortly after we went to the Oscars. So we went through pretty much everything with those guys. And I think we just got really close. And there's absolutely no reason for someone to open up emotionally with someone they're not close to. But we were close with them by the end of the year. And the interviews that we did about these complicated, sometimes painful topics, we did after the deployment a few months later at their military base in Italy.
And then the film that debuted last night on HBO, which will air constantly on HBO probably in the next month, called The Last Patrol, you have three men who came from this unit, and you walked with them. You walked the railroad tracks between Washington, D.C. and New York City to talk about combat. And one of the things you talked about is why it's so hard to give it up. When we come back, I'd like you to share with us some of the things that they said in that, because people can still see that on HBO if they have a subscription. But I want to talk about some of the things they told you about that. And then we'll come back and talk about some of the things that are going on in this region to help these people as they come back from these conflicts. We're talking to Sebastian Younger, filmmaker, Dr. Dave Calloway, Director of Operational and Disaster Medicine at Carolina's Medical Center, and Paula Broadwell, a leadership consultant with Charlotte Bridge Home and Lead Star and other organizations as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Donald Hack Diamonds, with an expanded showroom and parking now at their new location in Morrowcroft Village in South Park. Details at DonaldHack.com. And ABZ, Creative Partners, marketing and communication strategists committed to helping businesses succeed. Creative, scalable solutions and strategic advice available at ABZCreative.com. Only 5% of Americans have a direct tie to the military. This disconnect often leads to misperceptions about veterans. So how to bridge the civilian-military divide and valuing the contributions of veterans beyond the battlefield, the topic of the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes here at 10 o'clock. And we will continue our conversation about a similar topic. If you'd like to join it, Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org or Facebook or Twitter will get you to us, and we're coming right back.
The Common Core standards require kids to read complex works. In Reno, a fifth-grade teacher worried a tough poem would stump her students. Then she tried it.
even my historically low-achieving students, said to the class, it's a pattern. And they all went, oh!
Reading Common Core, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to three people, Paula Broadwell, Dr. David Calloway, and Sebastian Junger. He's a filmmaker. His film, Kurengal, This Is What War Feels Like, it will be screened this Friday at Wells Fargo's auditorium downstairs from the Knight Theater at 6 p.m., and he will be talking after that about the film and his experience in Afghanistan. It benefits Charlotte Bridge Home. But the film that aired last night for the first time on HBO, your film The Last Patrol, you talked to three guys who were in the Restrepo movie and who all served together, and you walk these railroad tracks from Washington, which is illegal, by the way, from Washington, D.C. to New York. And they told you about their thoughts about the war now that they've been removed from it. What kinds of things did they tell you?
Well, just a small correction. Two of them were combat vets.
Okay.
From Restrepo. And then there was me. And then there was another civilian journalist, a Spanish guy named Guillermo Cervera, who's a photographer, who was actually with Tim when he died. He was holding his hand in the back of a rebel pickup truck racing back from the front lines towards medical help. And Tim just didn't make it. And I became very close friends with Guillermo. None of us were going to go back to war again. And I just thought we would do what I started calling high-speed vagrancy. We had everything that we needed in our packs, and we started in Washington, D.C., walking along the railroad lines. We didn't have tents or anything because they attract too much attention. So we were sleeping under bridges and abandoned buildings and bathing in rivers and cooking over twig fires in the woods. And over the course of a year, I wanted to break it up so we could walk in each season. We moved up the railroad lines, dodging the police, encountering Americans, talking to them about the state of affairs in the country, and talking with each other about war. And we went from D.C. to Philadelphia, and then we turned west and headed for Pittsburgh. And all of us missed war, and we couldn't quite figure out why. And it was interesting because what wound up happening is over the course of our trip, the four of us got incredibly close. And we actually started to experience the thing that we missed about war, which was closeness. And it was a really interesting insight. I mean, we were all having trouble adjusting. Two of us were in the middle of divorces. Two of us had just had their fathers had just died. I mean, we were four men in various degrees of crisis and pain. And the bond that we had out there, hiding in the underbrush from the police and sleeping under bridges in the rain or whatever, the bond was just incredible. And also, finally, we really got to connect with our country. Railroad track goes right through the middle of everything. It doesn't avoid anything. It goes right through the ghettos and through the suburbs. And you encounter every aspect of America. And that, frankly, made me feel – it returned this feeling of Americanness to me in a really sort of lovely way.
Is that why you chose to walk 400 or 300 miles along a railroad track?
Yeah. I mean, again, a railroad track because there's a lot of no man's land around it. And so if you need to find a place to sleep, it's easier than on surface roads, of course. But also I like the idea that it was not quite sanctioned by the authorities, to put it mildly. And that introduced a slight element of being on your toes, sort of evasion and that reminded me a little bit of combat. And also, like I said, it just goes straight through these communities that otherwise you wouldn't encounter if you were driving or if you were on roads.
The purpose of war – we don't often talk about this, but I've heard actually Rush Limbaugh talk about this. The purpose of war is to kill people and to destroy things. And most of the people who fight our wars have never done that kind of thing before. They're trained to do that. And they're put through, I guess, some sort of as you were saying, Dr. Calloway, in the break, you were saying that part of the reason we romanticize this is that we have to give people stories to help them understand that it's okay to kill in these situations. But then we bring these people home, and they have to stop killing and stop destroying things. Is that a difficult transition to make?
I mean, I think it clearly is, and we were talking about no matter which religious group you believe in and belong to, the ultimate taboo is taking of another life. And so there's been extensive scientific study about how do you convince people to take another life and how do you make it seem just and valued. And then the challenge is we create these very effective leaders and killers, and they come back to society, and we need to figure out, you know, what do we do to integrate these people? And the fact is, killing is only a very small part of being a soldier in combat, and it's a minor part. I mean, there's camaraderie and brotherhood and leadership
and hardship
and this is what Sebastian talks so much about. And I think that's what we need to focus on. And Paula can talk about this idea of post-traumatic growth, which I'm a huge fan of focusing on. Paula, you want to?
Well, the military realized that there were some people who were coming back and who went on to live very happy, fulfilled lives and didn't suffer from post-traumatic stress and other issues, and other soldiers who took their life. At its peak, I think there was one soldier taking his or her life every 18 hours. Now we're around every 22 hours. We still have a problem in the veteran community writ large, all veterans that are living, one veteran every 65 minutes. But it's important, as Sebastian pointed out, to note that not all of those veterans served in combat.
Okay. Is part of the reason that we have such a high suicide rate among veterans because they cannot get the help they need from the VA, because we all know about the problems going on at the VA? Or is it something else? Is it that they don't want to come forward for help because it's not macho to get the help that's required in those situations?
I would say both of those, Mike. The VA is improving, and there's a great leader at the top now. I think General Shinseki was wonderful, but sometimes change is good. And the VA has moved from a 1 million case backlog as of last year, down to, I think, 600,000. So they're moving in the right direction. But 500 veterans die each year waiting for their claims. And a lot of veterans don't come forward, or some that do, they present with post-traumatic stress. They have to show a repeat occurrence of it. Some of them get through whatever that was. And others are just, you know, they realize it's such a bureaucracy and they're never going to make progress.
I mean, we talk about post-traumatic stress, and I used to be called shell shock in World War I, but there's more to it than that. Isn't there also survivor guilt?
Right.
I'm here. My buddy died right next to me. He's not here. Why me?
So, I think two things. One is just going back to the VA, because the VA is kind of a scapegoat right now. There are obviously issues, but I spoke with a former VA official a couple days ago, and so the numbers are 22 vets a day commit suicide, and of those, they looked at them, and 17 had not accessed or attempted to access veterans' mental health services at the VA. They surveyed the same population, and about 40% of the vets didn't know what their benefits were. And so, I mean—
Whose fault is that?
Well, I mean, I think that it's everybody's fault, and I know that's kind of a cop-out answer. I don't know who can
but
you attribute
when
it
you
to?
Leave
VA,
the military, but when you leave the military,
right,
are you not given a separation lecture or package with all the information you need to
no,
navigate
I mean,
you're, the world?
There are large-scale transition programs when you leave active duty that have expanded. But if you mm-hmm. think about the complexity of what needs to be communicated, healthcare, finance, insurance, job searching, skill transition, mm-hmm. the mental health and just the transition stuff. I mean, it's a massive undertaking.
So and that leads us to this conversation about North Carolina. We are the fourth highest number of returning veterans in the country, I believe. There are 155,000 veterans in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area alone. What kind of resources do these men and women need, and what kind of resources can we and are we providing for them? Paul?
There are a great deal of resources, Mike, and I'm just thrilled to be part of a community that is so patriotic. There are a number of nonprofit organizations in the community, from the USO, which is supporting soldiers still in uniform, to those supporting veterans in transition, like Charlotte Bridge Home. And Charlotte Bridge Home, for example, supports these troopers with housing assistance. In fact, Charlotte Bridge Home has just been asked to lead with the mayor and the county commissioner program to end homelessness for veterans in our community by the end of next year. This is phenomenal.
Is that possible?
I think it is possible. And it's part of a larger national coalition led by Mrs. Obama, but it takes leadership and it takes a public-private partnership because the government just does not have the resources. We have a number of organizations.
Stop there. This is a national disgrace. I don't often give my opinion, but it's a national disgrace. We send these people to war, and you're telling me we have the resources to fight wars on two fronts at the same time, but we don't have the resources to take care of these people when they come home? That's disgraceful.
I agree, Mike. And I think that's one of the challenges that veterans face when they come back, because they see they've put their life on the line. They left their family behind. Many times they lose their family.
And how can we not have the resources? I just don't understand it.
Well,
we spend trillions of dollars to prosecute these wars. Trillions. We don't have $1 billion to help these people?
I think this is a great call for citizens in our community to look at who they're electing and to make sure that supporting veterans and making prudent decisions on where we commit the use of force is a priority for those politicians. But I think we also have to just realize that a lot of this leadership comes from the private sector, from nonprofit organizations, from individuals who serve in many different capacities on boards and these.
And you were saying in one of the breaks that in this region, at least, we have a lot of good corporate citizens who are stepping up.
Yes. For example, last month I attended an event founded by a gentleman named Jim Killebrew. It was called Banking on the Community. And he has galvanized bankers in the community to come together to do a fundraiser to benefit organizations in the community. And the last 2 years, they've given funds to veterans. They raised $350,000 in an evening gala. And Patriot Charities does the same kind of program. So they're calling on the private sector to raise these funds, but also, very importantly, to educate and improve awareness in the community of the needs of these veterans, whether it's providing service dogs, which costs about $10,000 each, by the way, but those dogs can help with transition. Whether it's educating the educators in our community, the CPCC or UNCC, on the value of working with veterans. Bank of America just gave a $500,000 grant to CPCC for their veterans initiative. That's fantastic. And the government just does not have that money to give up so freely.
Of course, when a person comes back from combat, their transition into the back into the civilian world not only impacts them, it impacts their families. How can friends, how can coworkers not only help the vet, how can they be helped to deal with some of the problems that the vet might be presenting them because of their own difficulty in coming back to civilian life?
Well, Mike, you're hitting on some important issues because, again, we talk about this shared sacrifice and this disconnect. And to say the government is the only one responsible for the veterans, they should be responsible for the veterans. But the fact is our communities need to be responsible for these vets who have put their lives on the line. And that is taking into account their family needs as well. I mean, because the families are shouldering a huge burden here. You know, in my particular, you know, lens is through healthcare. And I think that the healthcare sector, and especially Carolina's healthcare, is the place to lead this because, again, if you talk about, you know, a multi-trillion-dollar industry, complex, multiple stakeholders, a bunch of conflicting interests, information technology, information security, and then a mission-driven organization, I mean, who else would you want to serve than a veteran? And not only that, but health ties to everything. Health ties to education. It ties to employment. It ties to family wellness. You know, and I think that we need to come together as a community, and the organizations, the businesses and nonprofits and just the people in society need to have the courage to step up and have the question and have the conversation.
I think probably Dave and Sebastian and I would agree that the biggest need in our community is for mental health services. And once you get your head right, you can focus on getting everything else right, getting back to work in a new way and so forth. And there's a problem in our society with availability of mental health resources. And the VA is trying to lead in that area here as well. There's a new facility opening in Charlotte. But it's an area where the private sector will have to step in to assist.
How difficult is it for these veterans to get that help if they want it? I mean, because you just said that I think out of the 22 young people that killed themselves.
Well, it's 22 vets of vets. All. So it's not just post 9/11 vets. It's 22 okay. veterans. And actually, most of them are over 50.
But 16 did not seek help. So if they were to seek help, would it be readily available?
There was a conference held here in Charlotte not long ago with leaders from the healthcare community, not focusing on veterans' mental health, but mental health in our community in general. And I believe it was stated that there were a million people that had presented needing mental health care, mm-hmm. including 300,000 children. And Michael Tarwater was saying we're trying to expand the capacity to meet those needs. And they're looking at innovative ways to do it. For example, video teleconference with a psychologist. You wouldn't think that would work. But just talking to someone and getting some counseling and guidance in life does go a long way.
We've been getting a lot of requests from listeners to provide information about credible charities for veterans. And we've got some links on our website. We'll put more on them at wfae.org/charlottetalks. But you work for several, do you not? Paula, you work for, as we said...
I advise and have served on the boards of several.
Okay. Charlotte Bridge Home being one, Purple Heart Homes, Patriot Charities. I think Team Red, White, and Blue is another. How do people find, if they want to give money or they want to give their time, how do they make sure that they're giving it to credible charities where the money and the help is going to the right?
That is a very important question, because the last thing you want to do is give your money just to get a T-shirt, give a T-shirt to a wounded vet, and it doesn't mean anything for them. You want your money to make a difference. And so I'd be happy to serve as a resource, but it really comes down to, what's your passion? Is your passion providing housing for service-disabled veterans? Then look at Purple Heart Homes, founded by two Iraq War vets here in our community, by the way, one of who's a double amputee, who came back to Charlotte and was devastated, as you can imagine. But his neighborhood, his community, helped to refit his house so that he could go on and establish a new life with this new normal. And now he's serving through his organization, Club for Black.
I have less than a minute. We have a question from a Vietnam vet who says, they didn't come home to the same kind of hoopla that today's veterans are returning to. Is there help out there, and what kind of help is out there for Vietnam veterans?
I don't think any of these organizations would turn away a Vietnam veteran. Purple Heart Homes, again, serves all service-disabled veterans from any era of war. And the VA, obviously, is open to all veterans.
Paula Broadwell, Army vet, author, and leadership consultant. Dr. Dave Calloway, director of operational and disaster medicine with Carolina's Medical Center, also a vet. And Sebastian Junger, filmmaker of Restrepo. Corinne Gall, This Is What War Feels Like, and the film that started last night on HBO, The Last Patrol. Thank you all for the hour.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.